We are talking today with Tyler Boudreau. Tyler Boudreau is a 12-year veteran of the Marine Corps Infantry. He was deployed to Iraq in 2004 as Assistant Operation Officer for an infantry battalion. Following the deployment, he was assigned as the commanding officer of a rifle company and was preparing to return to Iraq when he resigned his commission because of his growing reservations about the war. Today he writes and speaks broadly on his experiences and works with other veterans on many projects related to war. He is the founder of Collaborative Revolution, a not-for-profit humanitarian project to assist Iraqi refugees and immigrants resettled in the U.S., and is author of the book Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. Tyler, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Good morning. Thank you.
Start out and tell us, what was your motivation in writing your book, Packing Inferno?
Packing Inferno is sort of the end result of a lot of thinking and writing about my experiences and emotions and thoughts about the war. It actually started in Iraq. I had packed several books in my sea bag and just wanted to have some things to read, and I opened up the sea bag in Kuwait, and at the top of the heap was a copy of Dante's Inferno, which was sort of, it was unintentional. I hadn't meant to bring that book, but I did, and so I, you know, sort of said to myself, well, they say war is hell, so I'll go ahead and read it. So I was reading, you know, this journey of Dante and Virgil into the underworld, the nine circles of hell, as we were traveling from Kuwait into Iraq and up towards Baghdad. And I was struck by all these similarities between the experiences that I was having and also, you know, what I was reading in the book. And so I started just jotting down notes, and I knew at some point that I was going to have to express these emotions and these thoughts and these, you know, images that I was, you know, coming across. So when I got back from Iraq, you know, I began just sort of writing profusely. And in the beginning, it started as a sort of a fictional work, a novel. And I think at the time I needed it to be fictional because I needed characters to have this debate, you know, because there were things in Iraq that I was concerned about. There were a lot of methods that we were using that I was I just wasn't agreeing with. And we can talk about that a little bit later, but the point is that I wanted to kind of really get into that discussion. But meanwhile, I'm the commanding officer of an infantry company. So it wasn't so easy for me to just say, oh, this is all terrible. I mean, I'm in this position of authority, and I'm also, you know, responsible for Marines, and we're going back to Iraq. So I wasn't quite ready to just reject the whole program. It was more like, I need to have this discussion. And so these characters would have the discussion. Well, ultimately, that book did not do well because it got written, but it never got published. It wasn't that well done. But what was useful about it was that I put so much material down on paper. I mean, it was, you know, it was thick. And from there, I realized that there was some value in me writing and revising and going over these thoughts and memories again and again, which you do in revision process. And so I went through a couple of iterations until I came up with a book here, Packing Inferno, which is called a memoir, but I think of it more as a meditation. I think about these experiences and kind of explore what was I thinking in these moments? How did I come to the conclusions that I did? Where did my attitudes derive from? You know, and did I just track through my entire history as a Marine through the war? And so, yes, of course, there are stories about me, but they're meant to sort of illustrate the conclusions I came to.
What was your motivation in becoming a Marine in the first place?
Well, I joined out of high school in 1989. I enlisted, and my reasons for joining were very similar to most young men's reasons. I was interested in the personal challenge. I wanted to, you know, get in some tough training. I liked the idea of esprit de corps and the camaraderie and the nobility of serving the country. You know, kind of the usual pack of reasons that people go in. And you know, there wasn't a war at the time, and that so that didn't play into my decision like it does with the young people today. And of course I knew about the possibility of war and in fact looked forward to it. I saw war as the final test. I mean, there would be all these, there'd be boot camp and there'd be all these other training exercises. And in peacetime, that's like the, in the culture of military, that's the hierarchy of challenges, you know, which is the toughest training that you can go through, which all becomes meaningless once a war starts. Then all of a sudden the new hierarchy is your combat experience. So, I knew that the final test would have to be combat and wanted to meet that test.
So talk about your move to Iraq and your initial experiences there.
Well, I think that it's important to kind of set the stage a little bit, which I do in the book, Packing Inferno, which was we were the first Marine Battalion to go back to Iraq. So the invasion happened in 03. The Marine Corps, for the most part, pulled out of Iraq for the summer. And this is after the, you know, mission accomplishments, end of major hostilities speech, and so we sort of feel like we're in a concluding phase of Iraq. And then through that summer of 03, we see the insurgency starts to crop up, and you probably remember that the administration was a little bit resistant to that term at first. They were like, no, it's not really an insurgency, it's just a couple of guys. And then as the casualties, American casualties, start to creep up, you know, there's more pressure from not only from the press, but also from internal. I mean, you know, military officers and experts who've been in this business a long time recognized early enough, this is what we call an insurgency. We're going to have to deal with this as an insurgency quickly, or, you know, it's going to get out of hand. Well, it got out of hand anyway. But at that point in the fall of 03 is right about the time where the Marine Corps gets called back to go back to Iraq. And 1st Marine Division, who had been there under General Mattis, was going to return to Iraq because they had the experience already. They'd already been there for the invasion. And he was short a battalion and needed one more battalion. And I was on the East Coast. I was a Camp Lejeune Marine. And my battalion was that last battalion to go with him. So we deployed under General Mattis. And I was with 2nd Battalion, 2nd Marines. And we were notified, I want to say it was the end of November, right in the beginning of December, and we were going to set to deploy on March 1st. So it gave us 3 months to prepare for a type of operation that nobody had really experienced before. I mean, even the people who had been there had been primarily invasion, full-intensity conflict kind of situations, not a counterinsurgency operation. So we were really kind of, you know, inventing the wheels, you know, so to speak, even though we had some doctrine and there were some manuals, etc. But, you know, the famous counterinsurgency manual didn't come out until 06. So, you know, so we were calling it stability operations for the most part is how we referred to it. And the reason I sort of bring all this up is because I always like to point out that General Mattis, and those, some people know his name, he's got a pretty strong reputation. He's, you know, in the Marine Corps, and I think he's sort of considered, you know, kind of like a modern day Patton. You know, he's got that very aggressive kind of bulldoggy personality, and he's just very dedicated to understanding warfare on both an intellectual and, you know, kind of full spiritual, moral level, whatever it is. You know, I mean, he just has that kind of persona. But General Mattis was very concerned about how Marines would be treating Iraqis. He gave us a speech. He was out in California, but he flew out to North Carolina and gave us a speech about how he felt that the reason that there was an insurgency is because the army was mishandling Iraqis and they weren't extending the respect and dignity that the Iraqi people deserved. So he wanted to really emphasize this to the Marines, that we were going to do this thing right and we were going to really show them our humanity and really show the Iraqi people that the Marine Corps understood them and wanted to be their friends. And so that's kind of where you get this winning hearts and minds slogan. It is a slogan, but it really captured what we were trying to do well. And the reason why there's such an emphasis on winning the hearts and minds of the people is because any insurgency, if you know something about the military warfare world, an insurgency depends logistically on the unpopular support. So without that support, they can't hide, they can't move their traffic, their weapons, you know, all that stuff. So we know that if we can get the support of the people, the insurgency cannot operate and fails. So that's, therefore, that's why we have the, you know, the emphasis on doing good things for the Iraqi people. And, you know, and furthermore, as was advertised, this was a liberation, okay? And I know that people are dubious about that. And I accepted it at the time because I wanted a reason to get into a combat situation. And this is a story that is more fully fleshed out in my book, but I had been in for a long time, and I kept on sort of just by happenstance missing out. I missed out on the Gulf War, even though I was active duty. I missed out on Somalia. I missed out on Yugoslavia. I missed out on the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. And I, even despite my sort of maturity and sort of growing as an officer, and my attitude had become much more professional towards the business of serving in the military, I still had that sort of adolescent desire to be tested, as many young men do want. So I wanted a reason to go. And when they started talking about liberation and freedom and democracy, it was good enough. It was good enough, and I put all of that rhetoric, and I laid it all on my acceptance of orders to Iraq. And I had that luxury. I actually had the opportunity to say, no, I'm going to get out of the Marine Corps, or I'll take orders to this unit and go to Iraq. So I made the choice. I wasn't like others who sort of found themselves getting swept into it. I lost my train of thought there. There was this kind of emphasis on the liberating of the Iraqi people. And so there was a lot of pressure now internally, personally, on this being truly a liberation. I mean, it wasn't just like, okay, it's not just out there as political rhetoric. Now I've laid all of that on my acceptance, because I'm a little bit skeptical about the operation beforehand, but I'm like, okay, no, we're going to go for liberation. So this is why I pay particular attention to what we're doing to liberate. And I'm an operations officer. I'm an infantry officer, but at the time I'm in the position of as operations, which in training means I'm helping make the training plan, and in the theater of combat I'm managing forces and keeping track of what our operations are doing and all of those sorts of behind the scenes kind of stuff. So we start to prepare ourselves. We've got 3 months to do this. About 80% of the battalion is brand new to the Corps. They've gone through boot camp. They've gone through their initial MOS training, their infantry training, and then they've come to us. They don't know anything about the Marine Corps, basically. All of the commanders, platoon, company, battalion, all new to their jobs. I'm new to my job. We're all new to our job, not necessarily new to the Marine Corps, but new to our jobs, and we're trying to figure this thing out. So I'm looking around at what we're spending our time doing for this operation of winning hearts and minds. And what we spent our time doing was training for combat. We went to the range, we did a lot of shooting, we went to combat, you know, villages and practiced urban patrolling, we practiced raids, we also practiced some stability operation type of stuff, but the emphasis was on combat. And it was natural for us. We were an infantry outfit. That's what we do. It's not just a job description. It's a whole history built up over, you know, I mean, you could say centuries or even millenniums, a warrior culture that gets handed down again and again, and you come in, you enter into it, and, you know, you let it consume. I mean, it consumes you, but you allow it to consume you, and you then consume the next generation into this culture. And so to resist that kind of thought process is tremendous. It's very difficult. And we had a very difficult time seeing things in any other way but a fight, because we were an infantry outfit. And I really try to emphasize this because it has an impact on how we think of things in Iraq when we finally get there. And that's what we did. We trained mainly for combat, and we always had that kind of winning hearts and minds thing in the backs of our heads. I mean, you know, nobody forgot all about it. It always sort of came up here and there, but it was always a footnote to the overall training objectives. We had, like, for instance, we had a day of cultural training where we would learn a lot about, Middle Eastern culture and some of the idiosyncrasies of Islamic beliefs, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and I think, you know, it was like one long day in the theater. I mean, one day out of the 3 months that we were preparing, a quarter of the theater was asleep. You know, other ones, it was rising above their heads. I mean, I'm an officer and trying to pay attention. It was kind of boring even to me. And I mean, I'm not trying to put anybody down, but it wasn't the most exciting training you ever had. And Marines, generally speaking, aren't like really attracted to academic settings. That's why they're in the Marine Corps. I mean, you know, it's not a put down. It's just way, you know, it's just the way it is. The way I was. So it wasn't like this was the most fulfilling part of our, you know, training program. But then we get back out on the range and we're doing the stuff that we know and we love, the combat, the fighting, you know, and that sort of thing. Well, when we got to Iraq, we found that things were going to be pretty unclear as to who to fight. And that became the issue. And you've heard this story and everybody's heard this story. It's, you know, an insurgency by definition. You don't know who you're fighting. You know, the enemy is buried in the populace. They look the same. You don't know who's going to be shooting at you next. So the thing that became kind of curious to me was how are we going to react to this? And General Mattis had said to us he wanted us to use what he called wave tactics. And this is how we were going to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people. We were going to wave at them. And he said, every time you see an Iraqi person walking down the street, I want you to smile and wave at them. And you see, this is the way we're going to show that we mean to be their friends. You know, and so whether it made sense or not wasn't for us to say. He's a general and we follow orders. So that's what we did. We were driving up from Kuwait and, you know, I'm out the window of my truck and I'm waving with one hand and I'm pointing my weapon with the other. And so it didn't take long for me to understand that this was, you know, probably a pretty weird sight for the Iraqi people. You know, the Marines are pointing their weapons and they're waving. So which is it? But what's more important is how we viewed ourselves. And this is something I get into in the book. Because when I wave and smile at someone, I attach, you know, some feelings of, happiness or kindness or something like that. Unless I'm faking. And I don't think that we were faking. I wasn't faking. Maybe somebody was, but I wasn't faking. But when I hold a loaded weapon and I point it at somebody, I attach feelings of hostility. So right now you have this divided consciousness, and it has to be resolved. You will interact with that person. And this idea that is constantly being promoted by, you know, people in the military and, you know, the Department of Defense or whatever, this idea of, the, you know, our soldiers are diplomats and killers, I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it. You're either one or the other. And you might be able to switch from day to day, but in a moment, you can't be both. And so, you know, here we are, we're looking at these people holding our weapons and waving, and you're going to fall in one direction or the other. So, you know, you can kind of like, that ambiguity can kind of sit there for some period of time, you know, in your mind. It's sitting there. But it's got to be resolved when action is required. So, the action is you get attacked. And then you fall, you default to your combat training and you know, you respond and you shoot back. The next time you go out, you're looking around at all the people and you know you just took a casualty and you're saying, you know, we're going to be on our guard this time. and you start to drift away farther and further away from that, you know, kind side of you, the waving side, and you're, you know, more focused on the pointing your gun side. So this is what I found. The progression over the time that we were there was that people would get more and more sort of swept up in the frustration, the anger, the fear, also the killing culture, which is there. It's a part, it's a factor. So all of those things are weighing us towards that kind of fighting side of things. It's like we want it to be a fight. Even though we're not saying we want it to be a fight, it's like there's so many things egging us in that direction. For an officer, you know, in a promotion board, the guy who's got that combat experience looks better. I'm not, you know, the Marine Corps is not going to tell you you need to have combat experience to get promoted, but it sure looks good. Nice to have that Bronze Star with a combat V on it. That sure looks good on a promotion board. Now, I'm not saying that officers fight for medals. They don't. I really don't think that they do. I mean, there may be one in a crowd that does, but it's there in their heads. It's sitting in the back of their consciousness. And if there's an ambiguous situation, if there's a kind of a gray area where they could go either way, I'm saying that there's influences and pressures to pull one direction. That's all I'm saying here. And it's subtle. This is all kind of very, very delicate material, and it cannot be painted in black and white. And that's kind of the overall gist of what I talk about when I go around talking to people is these are very, very nuanced issues. The differences from one to the other, it's all very subtle. And we've got to get comfortable with those subtleties, and we've got to get comfortable with the ambiguities and talk about them and not have this black and white, you know, rhetoric, angry, you know, that doesn't get to the real meat of the issues.
So, and the longer, as you point out, the longer you stay there, then the more you drift into having a violent response to any given situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was definitely the case with us. And in 2004, things did get pretty violent. It was a rough time. General Mattis coined the term, no better friend, no worse enemy. And my battalion commander had written a letter home at the conclusion of our deployment to the families, and my wife included. And one of the lines he said was, something like, the latter part of the deployment was more no worse enemy than no better friend. And I thought about that, and I said to myself, that doesn't sound like mission accomplishment to me. That doesn't sound like we had fulfilled our goals. If the end of the deployment was more no worse enemy, we were doing more fighting at the end than in the beginning, it seems like that sounds like escalation to me. That sounds like things got worse. But he was telling us that we had achieved our objectives. And I was trying to understand how exactly, in what terms did we achieve them? Where was the success that he was talking about? Because I just couldn't put my hands on it, and still can't to this day. Figure out what he was talking about. And, you know, there's the, you know, when one considers the fact that this was a letter to the families and he wasn't trying to, you know, analyze the war from a critical point of view to them. But my point is that he was saying the same thing to us, you know, and I think he was probably saying the same things to himself. I don't feel like there was a lot of hardcore criticism, like, you know what, this is the same ball of wax. And then the next battalion, my battalion, went back to the same area the following year, and I wasn't with them. I was back at Camp Lejeune. And at the end of his time, in the same area of operation, he wrote a letter that said the same thing. We accomplished our mission, you know, the Iraqis are free because of what you did. And yet, when you looked at the news, things had continued to escalate. We had continued to take casualties. In fact, they had started to mount up even faster and higher. And you're saying to yourself, if they keep on accomplishing their mission, I'm having trouble reconciling the data here. And nobody else is really helping me out with that. I'm not getting any reconciliation from any authority. I'm not getting it. We can't just say that we were successful. Can we? Can we just do that? Can we just say, hey, we're successful? You know?
And there's no mechanisms within the military for you to publicly ask those questions without killing your career?
Yeah, that's difficult. There is certainly some degree, some room for, you know, for after-action critiques. And I mean, you know, I can't speak for the other branches, but the Marine Corps does that quite a bit. There's a lot of debriefing and after-action critiques and sort of saying, what did we do right? What did we do wrong? But what I found was that the tolerance for that was limited to the tactical operations. So in other words, there's two things that we evaluate. One is how well we did a particular operation, executed it, and how well that operation helped achieve the, you know, the end state that we were looking for. And we kind of spent most of our time critiquing the actual operation, which in most cases we did fairly well, and there would be mistakes, and that's what we would critique. You know, you should have been on the radio more than you were, or you should have been left when you should have been right. Other than that, good job. Well done, Marines. And so that would be the basis of success. Whether or not that had the effect that it was intended to, I don't know if anybody was even looking at those questions. Now, if you started to press those questions to the extent of real criticism for the, you know, the overall program, I think you would find yourself alienated, yeah.
So what were your reasons for resigning your commission?
Well, it was kind of under the same lines. You know, I felt that from a human point of view, in other words, they had a plan. The plan was to liberate Iraqis, and the plan was to include defending ourselves. So I sort of concluded at the end of our deployment that it was not possible for us at that point to befriend Iraqis anymore and survive. Our emphasis would have to lay in surviving, and it did. That's what we did. We stayed there. We survived. We defended ourselves. We defended our bases. We defended our patrols. And we did operations that helped Iraqi people a little bit, but the emphasis lay on just being there, just maintaining a presence. And if that was the only thing that we were really doing, just surviving and taking casualties along the way, I felt that that was not a moral choice. And I didn't want to continue to participate in that kind of operation. So I resigned.
And when you resigned, did you make your viewpoints clear about your resignation? That's why you were resigning? So that it would have some impact?
No. No, I did not. I did not leave the Marine Corps courageously. My time was up, and I opted to resign. I did not make a big stink about it. In fact, for me, there was still a lot of, you know, issues that I was trying to work out. One of the issues was, what do I say to my company of Marines about why I'm leaving 2 months before we're deploying? And I had a choice. Either I could explain to them what I felt about the war and why I was leaving, or I could keep my mouth shut and move on. And I decided that it was, the more correct answer was to leave without saying, because I had the choice to leave. My time was up, so I had the choice to leave. And anybody who had finished their time after the first deployment, they could go too. But the people who had to stay and had to deploy, I didn't feel like it was fair for me to tell them how outrageous I thought the whole war was, and you know, and they should feel that way too. And then, see you later, I'm out of here. And they would have to deploy. I felt that that was just not my role. Somebody, you know, they were going to have to find that for themselves or find it in a different source, but I just didn't feel like coming for me that was right. So I didn't say anything.
And at the time, did you have any vision of trying to challenge these policies from, and this thinking from the outside, or was it just to get out?
Challenging the policies. I spent some time thinking about things on the political level, doing a little writing about it. I mean, there's some discussion of this in the book, but what I found most compelling was the human dimension about it. the psychological dimension and the emotional dimension. And so this is where I've really focused my work. So all the things that we've just talked about, you know, these are the conclusions that I came when I was there, and I haven't really done much to develop those conclusions because that was the end of my experience. So everything I talked about was based on what I saw in Iraq. And a lot of things have changed and evolved in Iraq since then. I can't really speak to what's happening there now because I'm not there. But what I do spend my time thinking about now is how we all process these experiences, how we process the concept of war. And then when I say we, I mean both veterans and soldiers and civilians, society collectively. What do these cultural attitudes sort of force us into, you know, saying and thinking? How does me challenging the war challenge my identity? How does one's identity keep you from challenging, you know, institutions like war? And this has kind of been the emphasis of my work now. Talking about the politics is important. I'm just not the guy doing it.
So what do you think of our society's focus on violence and killing? How does that contribute to or interact with our policies that then eventually lead towards our engagements in war and the way that we train, you know, our military people?
It's really a worthwhile question, and I don't have any kind of definitive answer for it. I mean, this is a serious anthropological question. You know, how does, you know, society's cultural, you know, attitude towards violence contribute to its, you know, willingness or even sort of rushing off to war? It certainly seems like there's a link. And one of the things that I talk about a little bit, and this is not really my story or my study, but, you know, this process of desensitization that has sort of increased over the years. And we know, this is an old story, from World War II to Vietnam. They kind of really increased that desensitization, that, you know, numbing the individual soldier to the concept of killing so that he'd be more willing to, you know, shoot the enemy. So, that's the way the training has been geared over the years. And so by the time you get to 1989, when I went to boot camp, you know, it was a pretty vicious program in terms of, you know, how we would think about killing, with chanting killing and talking about, you know, you've heard all the story of the blood and the guts, and we get to really kind of relish the idea of fighting and ripping apart the enemy's bodies and those sorts of things. But what strikes me about all this is that when I went into boot camp, brand new 18-year-old kid, and I heard all the things that they had to say, I wasn't stunned. I wasn't thrown, like, whoa, this is really off the charts. I looked around, I heard what they had to say, and it resonated. I mean, I got what they were saying. Yeah, I mean, didn't know already, but it resonated with something that was already inside me. Now, either I'm psychotic, or I come from a society that has already been feeding into that violent culture. So to your point, yes, I think that whatever's going on in society, all these things you talk about, the movies, the video games, you know, clearly they're having an impact on the overall psyche, and so that I can go into the boot camp and not be too surprised when they talk about gouging eyeballs. Sounds all right to me.
It also seems there's paralleling that effort within the military to desensitize its people, that there's parallels to that within the greater society. For instance, the further, via the media, the further removal of images that show what's really happening in these wars, and getting where, you know, I guess it was about 100 years ago where, you know, the casualties were used to be primarily soldiers, and now the casualties tend to primarily be civilians. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, the disconnect. There does seem to be a disconnect on a lot of levels, not just from the media, between the battlefield and back home. And I do have some concerns about that. One of the things that I talk about a lot with people is you know, how to help veterans as they come home and they're dealing with these issues. And you often hear the idea of, I'll use Jonathan Shea's word, communalizing the healing. And what he's trying to get at is, you know, in order for a veteran to really heal, the community needs to bring him in together and say, we understand all the things that's, you know, you went through, that you saw, that you did, whatever, you know, and we're going to help get you back, reintegrate you back into our community. And there are other people who write about that as well, and they often draw on, you know, tribal traditions, of you know, this rite of, you know, passage back into the community. And, I mean, it sounds great to me, except the part where I don't think that it's possible. That's the part that bothers me. And the reason I don't think that this communalizing of healing is possible at this point in this community is because we haven't communalized the war. The war needs to be communalized for the healing to be communalized. And what I mean by that is that when we decide as a community, and I'm calling a country a community, when we decide as a community that we need to engage in armed conflict, this is a serious, serious decision to be making. And it needs to be done almost like locking hands and having this really somber moment where we say, we have no other choice. We have to take up arms, and we have to send, some of us have to go and fight and do terrible things and maybe have come back wounded or killed or, you know, have post-traumatic stress. But we make this decision because there's no other option. And that would be an example of communalizing war. And that way, when those people came back, it would be a natural transition to communalizing healing because you'd done this, you'd made this decision together. But that didn't happen in this case. This war in Iraq and the one in Afghanistan was not communalized. Yes, there's a difference between getting support for a war in you know, kind of rhetorical terms, and communalizing it. You know, getting the war fervor and saying, yeah, kill the bastards, that's not the same thing. That's not taking into account all of the sacrifice that will have to be made. And, you know, a lot of people talk about, you know, there being a need for a larger sacrifice on the part of all people, and that would be kind of, that would be part of the communalizing. I agree with that. Not sure exactly how that sacrifice should come about, but it's along the same theme, you know, of we all kind of share in this, and it better be the right thing, or we will all decide, no, this is not the right thing. But you don't get the feeling like we're really integral in this process of deciding whether or not we are or not going to war. I don't know. I was never asked.
So. Yeah, it seems like another complete disconnect between the wars that occur and our citizens. It seems like there's also a major disconnect, and you mentioned this in your book, from when soldiers return and they initiate the effort to talk to other people about what happened, and it sounds like the bulk of those people, for various reasons, just turn away and disconnect. They don't want to hear that, the important stories that you are trying to convey.
Yeah, I mean, the scenario you're describing is one of a whole slew of different possible scenarios of a veteran coming back, because, you know, there's no one. But in generic terms, you could say, I think fairly, that when a veteran comes home and is interested in kind of saying, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's tough to make the statement without generalizing too much, because there are people involved here. But, you know, a veteran might want to come back and express himself and say, you know, here's some things that I went through. I'm feeling kind of like, I'm feeling kind of turned over about this. I don't know what to think about it. We've had over 1 million service members deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, and that sounds like a big number, but relative to the size of our country, it's like less than 1%. So even if you included the families and friends of those people, you know, what does that bring you up to? 2-3%, maybe? That's not a lot of people, and that's a lot of people who are not touched by it at all and have no reason to think about it whatsoever. They know it exists, and I think that everybody knows somebody who's just living their life and has no impact on them. And they know they ought to care because they're like, okay, I ought to care. But in themselves, they're like, I have no reason to care. I have no incentive to care. There's nothing that's pushing me. I don't know anybody who's over there. I don't have anybody in my family. There's nobody, none of my friends are doing this. I've got my job. I still got my bills to pay. There's no real reason for me to care. So it's not like they're cold-hearted people, but there's just, you know, like you said, there's not much going on about the news other than, you know, it's still happening. But those clips, you know, they use those same clips again and again. You, if you watch the news enough, you see the same, you know, clip from like back in 03 or 04, and you're like, wow, it's the same thing going on in Iraq. But here's the thing that gets tricky, is that you have all these different, in real terms, you have all these different real scenarios. So in other words, you might have some guy who comes back and his experience is positive. Everything he did was good. Maybe he didn't experience violence, or the violence he did experience was to him a positive thing because maybe, you know, he got caught in an ambush and he defended his fellow Marines or soldiers and, you know, and saved the day. So maybe from his point of view, it's been 100% positive. And he comes back and he's not dealing with post-traumatic stress, because not everybody does. Just because they saw or experienced violence does not mean they're going to have post-traumatic stress. So from his point of view, it's all positive. Okay, that's one possible returning veteran. Then you got another guy who maybe he didn't experience anything. He was a welder, and he was down in some base. Never went out beyond the wire. Never saw any explosions. Never saw anything. But has come to view the war in negative terms. He's just like, something about this thing's just not sitting right with me. I don't like it. I've been reading the newspapers, and I'm over here, and I'm just not liking it. And this is a common story. And you got another one. You know, you get a guy like me. I was involved at a, you know, sometimes in a direct way where I was in firefights, and then there was other times where most of the time I was not. Most of the time I was in a command operations center directing units. But yet still pretty involved in the fight. And I come to view the things. And so you see all these different scenarios. It's not just I oppose the war or I support the war. It's very, very gray. And then the next factor is, what are the communities they come home to? It might be a community where nobody's paying any attention at all. Like, it's just not a military community. There's nobody in the military, and everyone's just kind of doing their jobs, and that's it. So that person coming home is dealing with people who just don't know. Maybe they don't really care that much. Then you got another community that's like really pro-war, that maybe it's like a working class community and they're just like all about it. They have their big Memorial Day parades. And maybe that guy who came back is like not feeling too positive about the war. That's a tough community to come back to. I think this is not such a great thing. Who's he going to tell that to in his community, in his family and his friends? It's a very tough scenario. And then, of course, that could be reversed. Somebody who's like feeling really like proud about their experience, and they go home to a, you know, a very liberal community or something like that, where everyone's like waving their peace banners, and you're like, these people just don't get my experience. They just don't know what it was like over there. They don't know what it, you know, all the things that you know, you'd expect them to say. So you see all these different scenarios, and then you've got the issues of post-traumatic stress working in there. Maybe they all have it. Maybe some of them have it. You know what I mean? There's a million combinations. So when people say to me, what should we do for veterans? I say, you know, I don't have a recipe for you, because there's just too many variables here. And, you know, we've got to just take this case by case. The one thing that I would say is that politics has, you know, an uncomfortable tendency to creep into the discussion, no matter how you feel about the war and your experience, particularly if you have post-traumatic stress, because, you know, it's without, whether you want to acknowledge it or not, when a guy comes back and he's feeling off about his experience, it is an indictment of the war. It sounds an awful lot like criticism. Man, you know, it was terrible. You know, guys are getting shot up, or it was terrible. You know, we shot up an Iraqi person at a checkpoint. It was terrible. An IED went off and his head ended up in my lap, and that kind of thing. I mean, those kinds of stories, no matter how you slice it, are indictments of war. And they should be, because it's a horrific, you know, experience. But in the climate that we have going on in America, I think it's so black and white and so rigidly, you know, camp based. Everyone's kind of in their camp. That someone says it was terrible, and right away it's criticism, and that just doesn't that's not productive. It's not a productive attitude. And on the flip side of it, you have, you know, maybe a liberal community, and a veteran says, it was terrible, I'm really feeling racked about this. And they're like, yeah, go peace, you know, you're one of us. And maybe that's not exactly where he's at. Maybe this is an emotional response to something. Maybe he's not making a political statement. That's possible too. So, you know, this is my point, is that it gets the politics of war get very, very muck up and complicate the reaction to veterans when they come home. And the reaction of veterans to themselves. You know, that identity issue is huge. Who am I? Am I like the working class, blue-collar guy who like supports the troops, but I'm not feeling so good about the war? How do I deal with that? Forget about when my friends and family are around. How do I deal with it with myself?
So one of the things you're doing is you're in Seattle to begin a bicycle tour across the country.
Yep.
Can you talk more about that? Because I think that kind of goes towards creating dialogue that is necessary to for us to further understand ourselves on this.
Yeah. Okay, so what I'm doing is I'm starting here in Seattle, and that's tomorrow at noon. I'll be leaving Gasworks Park, and I am riding my bike across the country, and I should probably say bicycle, because I often get asked if I'm taking my Harley. I'm taking my bicycle across the country and going to end up in my hometown of Northampton, Massachusetts, which is Western Mass. And along the way, I'll be stopping in communities and doing readings and having discussions and sort of just joining gatherings and meetings and whatnot to talk about, you know, sort of some of the things that we're talking about today, but mostly to talk about, you know, that human experience kind of thing. You know, the politics, like I said, they always kind of come in, and I'm always happy to offer my opinion, but that's not what this trip is about. It's not about, you know, my agenda. I don't care who shares my opinion on politics. What I want to do is get a conversation going that really gets beneath the cultural frameworks, that gets beneath or beyond or transcends, whatever word you want to use, gets away from, you know, those standard rhetorical arguments. And I'm talking both sides, from left and right. I've talked to both, and both of them, you see people who just kind of, they're not even thinking through their own rhetoric, and we got to work these things through and find out how, you know, the consciousness conflicts with both arguments. You know, we'd like to have our kind of our nice, you know, perfectly formed sort of political or world views, and that's nice, but you know, when you're talking about real people, that things get very complicated. And you're like, wow, this isn't fitting my, you know, kind of vision. And the only way to kind of get through those things even is to talk, you know, really think through them. It's hard stuff. So for all the people who are out there just kind of doing their jobs and not paying any attention, I'd like to get them in the conversation. People who are in the conversation, I'd like to get them to maybe, you know, let's complicate the situation a little bit. Let's make this conversation a little bit more difficult. And let's get off of our, you know, our particular stools and you know, kind of move around a little bit and challenge ourselves. And I think that one of the things that I've done to decide where I'm at on things is I always start with an assessment of myself. How is it that I have a particular view? Where did I come from? What made me, you know, grow into this attitude or that attitude? And that helps me to understand how I want to think about things now. And I think everybody needs to do that, a self-assessment, challenging your identity, challenging your own views first. Have that whole conversation by yourself first. That is a scary thing to do for people. Scary. Because, you know, I mean, our identities, it's precious. And sometimes those identities relate to our incomes and our, you know, You know, so for instance, if I'm working, you know, I'll just give you a very easy, concrete example, but if I'm working for a defense contractor and I start to have feelings that I'm not so sure that I'm digging the way our military is being used. I still think the military is a positive thing, a bunch of great guys. I'm not sure that I like the way they're being used at this point. Now, who am I going to share that story with at work? I don't think that that would go over that well. Now, you know, I suspect, I've never been working in one of those companies, but I suspect that it's similar to the military in that it's never so very overt. You know, it's not like someone says, if you criticize the war, you're fired. Maybe that happens, but I'm betting it's more like, you know, Tyler's kind of a black sheep. Maybe they just like someone else better. You know, well, yeah, Tyler's okay, but I like this guy better. He seems more into it. He seems more positive. He's always got new ideas, fresh ideas. Am I going to be coming up with fresh ideas if I'm feeling a little ambivalent about the war? Probably not. So, you know, this is the way I see things being played out. And this gets back to the identity thing. So if I sense that danger to my livelihood, I'm going to be less, you know, likely to start challenging my own identity. And then when someone else comes up and challenges my identity, I want to be defensive or, you know, or just shut them out altogether. And this happens all the time. The defense contractor example is a very simple one, but there are people who are tied in all sorts of ways. I think we all are. All of us, me included. And I always try to ask myself, okay, how am I tied in? How am I challenged? How are the, you know, the influences of life making me think a certain way? And sometimes I can't resolve them. Sometimes it's just like, well, right now that's just the way it is. I just have to accept that. That's, you know, you can look at it as hypocrisy, whatever. It is what it is. But I think at least acknowledging is the first step, and then eventually maybe you can start to deal with it.
Have you always asked questions like that, or is that another...
No, the sort of pulling things apart in Iraq, you know, feeling these conflicting emotions, I started to notice them and just kind of getting into the habit of like, wow, I'm feeling this, and I'm feeling this. This doesn't make sense. And as an infantry officer, you know, we're very kind of focused on the mission statements. You know, we draft these things for a reason. They're not just like extraneous pieces of paper that have no meaning. I mean, the mission statement is everything, which says here's what we're going to do, when we're going to do it, and why we're going to do it. So, you know, we're all like into that. That's our mentality. I mean, they have like whole long schools in the military how to make these orders correctly written and meaningful and how to fulfill them, and it's all about mission accomplishment. I mean, you hear that phrase, mission accomplished, it's pervasive in our society because, well, you know, everybody knows that's the pinnacle. It's the most important thing in an operation, mission accomplishment. So from that kind of intense perspective, I'm looking at our mission going, I'm having trouble seeing, one, that we are accomplishing it. Okay, that's kind of like my political stance on it. But deeper than that, I'm saying, I'm not sure that humanly this is possible, what they're asking. I'm not sure that I can love Iraqis and hate Iraqis at the same time. They've trained me to kill and, you know, to be aggressive and to harness that kind of energy. That means closing off the empathy. But at the same time, they're asking me to reach out to Iraqis, and that's an empathetic response to Iraqis. And those two are completely antithetical. And I just sort of started stumbling upon these disparities among many within myself. And so as I started to kind of unravel those things, I said, wow, there's some use to this exercise. This is kind of a useful thing. I'm coming up with some ideas here that are kind of useful, and I think I'm going to continue to do that. I'm going to continue to kind of peel the layers back and see exactly, you know, what I'm all about. So, that's about the origin of it. Before that, I was pretty much like everybody else. I was just kind of doing my thing, and I was allowing whatever, you know, disparities or ambiguities out there to just kind of like just sit there, just lurk. But in the context of war, it was not so simple to just let them be because, you know, serious action was required. You know, we're talking about obviously killing and getting people getting killed. So you had to sort of make a choice. Where there was an ambiguity, sooner or later you'd have to make a choice how you were going to behave, how you were going to think about something.
In addition to your book, Packing Inferno, is there other resources you have that people can turn to find out more information about your cycle trip and your writings?
Yeah, right. I've got a website. It's tylerboudreau.com, and you can find a lot of information, one about the cycle tour. You can also, you know, see all the various articles I've written for different papers, and some more information about the book is there as well.
All right. I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Okay.
We've just been talking with Tyler Boudreau. He is author of the book Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. And again, you can find out more via his website, tylerboudreau.com.